The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots. I'm James Hill. I'm joined today by The Spectator's Isabel Hardman and Sophia Gaston, Director of Foreign Policy at Policy Exchange. Now, Isabel, I think, first of all, the debate in Westminster today has really been dominated by the attack on Monday, which killed three British aid workers, and now the consequent debate around should Britain impose arms sanctions on Israel. Talk us about this different issue and how the politics of Gaza are continuing to play out 6 months after 7th of October.
Yeah, so Rishi Sunak has been interviewed about this today, and obviously he's called the attack. He said he was appalled, and he said he's told Benjamin Netanyahu that, and also that he's been telling Israel that it needs to do more to protect civilian lives. What Sunak personally is coming under pressure over is arms sales to Israel. So you've had Lord Ricketts, you've had Alan Duncan, and then you've had a number of opposition parties, so the SNP and the Greens, not particularly surprising, saying that the government should suspend arms sales to Israel now. Labour has a slightly different approach, but it's not that far off what the others have been saying, which is that the government should suspend arms sales to Israel if government legal advice suggests that it has broken international humanitarian law. And there have been, over the past few weeks, suggestions that that advice has already been given, that Israel is breaking that. And notably from Alicia Kearns, who is the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, who's obviously well-placed, better placed than the most to know what might be being said within Whitehall on this. So Labour's position, again, you know, if this advice has already been given, then Labour is not that far off the others who are saying it should be suspended now. Rishi Sunak is still sticking to the line that he's had really for months now, which is when he's asked whether Israel has broken international humanitarian law, he doesn't answer. He just says, we consistently tell Israel it must do everything it can to comply with it. Now, I don't know whether that is going to continue to hold when you've had this attack. You've had Netanyahu obviously saying there's going to be an investigation into what happened. But given you've got three British aid workers who've been killed among the seven overall, I think there's a possibility that things may have to shift in terms of the way that the Prime Minister at least talks about this, if not an actual policy change.
And Sophia, first of all, talk us through the international reaction to this. President Biden overnight reacted to what had gone on, saying he was heartbroken by the events and the killing of seven different aid workers. And second of all, could you just give us a sense, perhaps, of how the international community is viewing events in the Gaza Strip and the ongoing conflict, given that it seems, looking at polls, Israel is in danger, perhaps, of losing a lot of public support in the way in which it's prosecuting this conflict right now?
Well, the international reaction has been, as you would imagine, these are innocent humanitarian workers who are, you know, were just trying to do their best in extremely difficult conditions. From what I understand, they had actually made their presence known to Israeli authorities, you know, to prevent such a situation occurring. So they'd done everything right and everything by the book to try and get this really vital aid in. And the reaction has been one of complete bewilderment and shock, really. And I think it has crossed a line, and it's really difficult to see how we go back to where we were before, because everything was already in such a precarious place. And I think the killing of aid workers, particularly given the fact that the aid workers have come from the countries that have been giving the most kind of robust degree of support, I think that does really sort of flip the equation a little bit. You know, I think many countries have been trying to put pressure on Netanyahu to pull back and take a more cautious approach in Gaza, and starting to ask the questions about really where is this all going. And I think in many ways a lot of the carrots clearly haven't worked, and a lot of the sticks that have been deployed thus far, the quite robust diplomacy that we've seen from President Biden and so on, you know, it just doesn't seem to be landing. And so I think it may be that actually these kind of core allies have to start really putting pressure on in terms of the questions about what comes afterwards, you know, the way in which Gaza's going to be governed and structured and taken care of. And I think the fact that there is increasing a feeling that there's going to have to be some kind of peacekeeping function there for the international community, I think perhaps that does create an opportunity to start deploying a little bit more leverage here and trying to get to things to come to a conclusion. We have to remember that when Israel responded to the appalling atrocities of the 7th of October, you know, their intention was to, you know, eliminate Hamas. And certainly there are a lot of people in Israel who do not feel comfortable living side by side with a Palestinian state in which Hamas continues to play a really important role. So the situation is really, really difficult here. But I think we are coming to the point where patience is wearing very thin amongst the allies. And I would imagine that in the coming weeks, if certainly not the next month, there will be a lot of pressure on whether or not arms sales can actually be called into question here. And we might have to start using sticks like that, which I think is something that we never really thought we would have to come to.
And elsewhere, Isabel, at home, we have the latest in another series of very difficult polls for the Conservatives. This one at least puts them on three figures, winning at the next election, with Labour running up another Pyongyang-style majority. This one of around 150 or so, with Keir Starmer tipped to win just shy of Tony Blair's mammoth majority of 1997. And the Conservatives tipped to win just 154 seats, down from the 365 they won in 2019. Just talk us through this poll today. And really, we've seen a bit of fluctuation. I mean, they're all pretty bad for the Conservatives. But the one on Sunday was 98 for the Tories. This one's 154. What do you think is going on here? And how seriously should the Conservatives take all of these different polls?
I mean, the Conservative line about this YouGov MRP, which, as you say, is a, you know, seat-by-seat poll, the Conservative line will be, we're not in an election campaign yet. People are still just... They still like to say we're in the midterm, which I think is stretching the definition of midterm beyond its elasticity. And I think what it does show, and what the, you know, you get variable numbers from poll to poll, but consistently, whether it's they're just in triple figures or they're just down into double figures, that the Conservatives are in real trouble, and that actually Conservative MPs, cabinet ministers, who would not really have spent that much of the election campaigning in their own seats, are going to have to go back to their seats to try to avoid an Ed Balls 2015 style moment, where they've been so busy around the country trying to get their colleagues re-elected that they find that actually someone else has taken their own constituency, and they have a sort of 2 a.m. shock unemployment moment. So I think there's 11 cabinet casualties in this latest poll, including Jeremy Hunt, who's obviously been under some threat for a while. I think it's interesting that once again, you've got Reform on 12% of the vote, no projected actual seat gains here, which just shows the impact that the party has is not really about winning parliamentary seats. It's about losing the Conservatives their seats in a number of areas and sending their voters and their MPs, it has to be said, into a tizzy about the Conservative Party not being robust enough on immigration and on other matters.
And Sophia, we've got a cover this week in which we have Starmer's supermajority depicting hordes of newly elected Labour MPs trying to crowd over Keir Starmer and just one or two on the back benches of the Tories, obviously suggesting, you know, a Labour government of, you know, three-figure levels. What would you say would be the big differences between Labour and the Conservatives on foreign policy? And can you just talk us through a couple of areas in which they particularly disagree, either sort of really big differences or slight nuance, which will nevertheless have an important reduction as a result of it?
So I think some of the areas in which we'll see a difference will be sort of about tone and posture. If you're thinking about the relationship with Europe, this government has sort of started from a position of disengagement as the baseline and, you know, prizing engagement from there, whereas a Starmer government will start with the principle of engagement and, you know, keeping an eye on domestic politics and how far people are comfortable going. So I think that will be one thing. I think they will want to do things like, you know, have a bit of a renewed push on multilaterals. I think there'll be offers for some parts of the world that maybe we haven't been talking about as much recently, for example, Africa. So I think there will be a sort of a stronger kind of forward humanitarian focus and tone, and there'll be a lot more of an integration of climate policy, I think, back into the kind of foreign policy arsenal there. But I do think it's important to remember that actually many of the fundamentals will stay the same. And that's partly because, in a way, Labour, if you think about where they're coming from the 2019 Corbyn debacle, you know, they're having to really reach up for credibility on national security there. So I think in many ways you will hear this continuity on a lot of security and defence apparatus. So we know, for example, that they are very much going to stay committed to things like AUKUS, the pact with the United States and Australia. So a lot of that will be business as usual. The other reason why there won't be so much change is because, as with many areas of domestic policy, there's not going to be a lot of money to spend. And not only is there not going to be a lot of money to spend, but there's also going to be someone in the Treasury who's going to be quite a powerful figure there. So I think Treasury brain will continue to play a very large role in both defence and foreign policy. And, you know, I think that is concerning to a lot of people, because in many ways, you know, because Labour has been out of power, well, it will be 15 years by the time they would come in. You know, I think there's a lot of people at that sort of defence industry, whatever, that look to Labour and think, oh, they're going to solve all the problems, all the issues that we haven't been able to, you know, fix with this government, and maybe even, you know, getting us up to 3% of defence spending and so on. This is a Labour government would be willing to do that. And I just don't think that's necessarily going to be the case. The other final consideration is also around the domestic forces that will shape their foreign policy. Something that we very much know now is that there is a lot more integration between the domestic and the international, and also kind of the interests of your political base is a really important factor there. And particularly with the Labour base, you have a lot of kind of diaspora communities, and then you also have a lot of kind of, you know, people who have very strong interests in a lot of different conflicts and geopolitical hotspots around the world. So all of these voters are going to want to have a say in shaping Labour's foreign policy posture. So I think the government's going to have quite a bumpy ride. They're going to be under a lot of pressure of high expectations. And whether they can deliver when they don't have much money to go around, I think it's going to be quite tough.
Governments may change, but Treasury brain endures. Thank you, Sophia. Thank you, Isabel. And thank you for listening to Coffee House Shots.